everybody, and welcome back to Hysteria Radio. I'm your host, Joe Fusaro, and today we're going to be talking writing, music, and expressive arts in mental health recovery. Today we have a very special guest. She was actually one of the first people I chatted with in Brave Chat. She is a member of NAMI. She's a member of This Is My Brave. She is also an NCAA basketball player. She played for Tennessee and the University of Arizona. She's a former U.S. Olympian, and now, just recently, since August, she's been a best-selling author of the book Bipolar Disorder, My Biggest Competitor. Wow, what a resume. So this is Amy Gamble. Thanks for joining us, Amy.
No, thanks for having me, Joe. Looking forward to our conversation today.
Definitely. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good, good. So I'm reading your book, which is amazing. Why don't you give us a little bit of background for those of our listeners that haven't read it yet?
Sure. So the whole idea behind the title of the book is that I've been very fortunate enough to be on a world stage competing against incredible competition, and certainly had a lot of challenges and struggles along the way. And just in my journey in life, I had a lot of different challenges and struggles, even when I was working in, you know, for Fortune 500 companies. But what I have found is that there was never any greater competitor, nothing more difficult to overcome than bipolar disorder. And that's kind of the pathway I took in writing the book, was about my journey with mental illness and how that unfolded in my life, and really my, I don't know any life different than having mental illness in there, whether it was my family members or whether it was myself. And that's kind of where I pick up and talk about how bipolar disorder affected me, and how it affected everything that I was doing at that time, whether that was work, relationships, or career down the road, and that's kind of the pathway. And then at the end, you know, in the last couple of chapters, I really talk about recovery and what that looked like for me, and how I was able to really just turn all of my focus toward getting better, and that was really important to me to share.
And you and I talked about that, you know, how as an athlete, you know, when the athletics doesn't work to, I don't know how to say this, maybe to release the stress that it was relieving at one point, like when you don't have the ability to do that with athletics anymore, how do you channel that energy that you've been using your whole life? Because I played sports all through high school. I was big into working out when I got out of high school and in college. And then all of a sudden I had a couple shoulder injuries where I couldn't, you know, work out anymore, and I couldn't play sports anymore. I loved baseball. I loved football, and I just couldn't do it. So I needed to find a way to channel this energy. And do you think that writing is something that helped you get through that?
I think that writing is almost like a magic potion, really, and being able to take your thoughts, whether that's journaling in the moment or doing like a free writing or even just telling your stories and getting your stories down on paper.
Definitely.
I think it's powerful.
Yeah, yeah. And I have a lot of people tell me that they're not writers. And then I ask them, well, do you post on social media? Have you ever told your friends a story? I was like, because basically, you know, then you're using the same technique that a writer's using. And so take me back to when you played at Tennessee. What was that experience like? And how did you start feeling mental health symptoms come about at that time?
Well, to get to Tennessee to play for somebody who I admired tremendously, who's a legendary coach, Pat Summitt,
yeah,
who unfortunately passed away last year with Alzheimer's disease. But that was an all-time dream of mine, something that I just was sort of surreal being a part of the Lady Vol family. And what happened to me was my mother had gotten ill in the end of my freshman year and had a mental health crisis situation. And that really impacted me a lot more than I thought it would. Mm-hmm. And really didn't know how it was going to impact me, to be honest. So later on that year, my concentration started to go. I started to sleep a lot longer, getting very lethargic, and really all these symptoms of what I have later, of course, learned is from depression. Right. And I found myself lying in my room one day in my apartment, lived on the Tennessee River, and was looking out the window crying. And, you know, the thought that came into my mind was I should just go jump off the bridge. Okay. And it was the first time that I ever had suicidal thoughts. And it was just so profound in that moment and so real and scary. And then I had to make a very difficult decision in leaving school and leaving my dreams behind. Yeah. And so that was the first marker in time where mental illness would play a very remarkable role in the decisions that I would have to make. Wow. And that's sort of the start of my journey with what later became diagnosed as bipolar disorder.
You know, and a lot of people don't, you know, realize at the time that that's probably one of the hardest decisions you ever had to make. And then I know that when I left college, I wasn't under, you know, I didn't have the commitments that you had. But when I left, I was really hard on myself because I thought that I had failed, and I didn't look at it as it was the illness that, you know, made me not able to finish college. Did you put any extra weight on yourself, or was it easy for you to make that decision to leave?
Oh my gosh, it was so hard. Yeah. Because I had been also in the public eye, and there was a lot of backlash from that, and people who said that I was never good enough to play there anyhow, and I always choked. And so I received a lot of very negative feedback from that standpoint. I did enroll in school at West Virginia University. So I continued on with school, but it was very, very difficult. Right. And right. Of course, I felt like a failure and felt like my dreams were over.
You said that they made you take a year off, that you were ineligible to play basketball, right?
Yeah, I couldn't play basketball, and that also meant I had to pay for school because I didn't get a release from the University of Tennessee. And so, you know, we were a family with humble means, and so paying for school became much more challenging than it had been because I was on a full scholarship. So wow. Now all of a sudden there's that spiral of what happens with mental health when we have crisis situations. You know, it starts to spiral into personal lives and our dreams and then into our finances. Yeah. And that certainly impacted me.
Yeah. Yeah. In my NAMI talk, I mentioned something about how the two heaviest things for me to carry ever were guilt, which I say is more like, it's less guilt and more disappointment.
Then you let yourself down. You know, I think that guilt is so incredibly powerful that as a negative emotion, and then it feeds into that to shame. Yeah. And the things that we say to ourselves, you know, I'm not good enough. I'm not enough of fill in the blank. You know,
right.
I wasn't strong enough. I wasn't tough enough. I wasn't smart enough. I really wasn't good enough. You know, all those things.
Yeah. So then take me back to, so you leave, you go to West Virginia. Were you getting treatment at this time?
I wasn't getting any treatment. What I did was arranged all my classes to be in the afternoons or evening so I could sleep all day for the most part. I'd get up at noon and then wander my way to classes and just did what I could to survive. Wow. And that's kind of how I muddled my way through until the spring came. And I'm not sure if it was, seasonal change that affected my mood or what, but the springtime came, and then I had an idea of trying out for a totally different sport that I never played. And that kind of put me on the road to a whole different journey.
So that's,
it changed my life.
That's when you got involved with handball for the Olympics, right?
Yeah, that's when I got involved in team handball. And I had seen the sport played at one of the Olympic sports festivals. The Olympic sports festivals were a small mini Olympics that they held every year except the Olympic year. And I had made the team a couple times when I played basketball. And a sports writer friend took me to this sport called team handball, and he planted the seed and he said to me, "You should play this sport one day because I think you'd be really, really good at it." And so that's kind of how that started. And I just called him up and asked him, you know, could I have a tryout for an Olympic sports fest team? And I tried out and made the team, and then they selected a national team to train together. We had to train full time because obviously we had to learn the sport and transition from other sports. And so we did that. We moved to Marquette, Michigan, and started training about 8 hours a day and traveled all over the world for competition.
That's unbelievable. And how is the whole Olympic process? Is it really, it's you eat, sleep, and breathe whatever sport you're playing, right?
You do. That's your life, and that's, you know, your job. And then on top of that, some people had jobs outside of that. I was very fortunate that I had a couple sponsors that paid for incidentals and things. But that's it. From the time you wake up until the time you go to bed, you know, we were living eventually at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. And so we got to see a lot of different athletes come in and train. Who would be there for special events or for weekend training types of events. And it was just, the whole experience was just amazing and something that I'm, you know, forever grateful that I had the opportunity to participate in.
Oh yeah. It's an unbelievable honor. That's amazing. So what was it like when you came back? I know that you decided to go back to school. You wanted to play basketball.
I did. I went to University of Arizona. I still had some eligibility left after transferring from Tennessee. And I wanted to finish school because I dropped out of school to play handball. And I ended up going back to U of A in Tucson. And I got a chance to play basketball that year. And I got a chance to prove to myself and perhaps the rest of the folks in the basketball world that I actually could play college basketball. And I got selected as a ball-pack conference team person and led the team in scoring and rebounding. So that was a huge confidence booster for me and kind of put an exclamation point on my basketball days.
Yeah. What a way to go out. But and actually, you ended up playing for the Seattle Reign, right? Professional basketball.
I did. I only played for about a month. I was a player that came in. Somebody had gotten injured during the season, and so they brought a player in. And I mean, I was a 12th player on the bench.
No, that's still pretty cool, though. That's still really cool to the rest of us that didn't play any professional sports, Amy. You got to think of it that way.
It was so funny. I was talking to a group of high school players the other day, giving a little motivational talk, and I was saying, you know, when you make a mistake, you got to focus on doing it over again and believing that you're going to get the next one right. So I was giving them this example of, you know, I'm on the free throw line, 10,000 people in the stands playing professional basketball, and I airball the first free throw. and then I look over to my teammates, and they're all cheering me on, and then I make the next one. So it's just about, you know, shifting your mind and believing that even if you fail, that you can get back up again and do it better the next time.
That's unbelievable. And so let me ask, with the bipolar, when did you get your first diagnosis for bipolar?
I was diagnosed in 1999, and I came into the system in a mental health crisis. I had a psychotic episode.
Okay.
And I was hospitalized.
Okay. And you didn't know anything before this?
I had no idea. I was diagnosed in the early 90s with depression.
Okay.
Went to a family doctor, was really having a hard time functioning, and it was impacting my entire life. And so I took myself to the doctor. I thought I had something physically wrong with me, but he diagnosed me with depression. And that's when this sort of duel with self-stigma began. And so certainly when I got diagnosed with bipolar disorder, that just continued on and just got more powerful and more overwhelming, that I did not want any part of a diagnosis of mental illness.
Yeah.
And I wasn't gonna believe that me, an athlete, could have such a thing.
Right, right. As many of us don't want to believe that we, you know, be, and they, I feel like I was really undermined at some points too. Like, I was in shock that people would question my thinking. You know, it's like, how can you do that to me? Rather than, I think people just really wanted me to get help because they didn't like seeing me the way that I was. And I was very self-destructive, and I was just, you know, subconsciously doing things to hurt myself all the time without even realizing it at some points. But I really felt like they were questioning my sanity, and that offended me.
Yeah, I'm with you. I didn't want people questioning my credibility.
Right.
At the time that I got diagnosed, I was a director at a large company, a multi-billion-dollar company. So I had a really high position, and my sanity was what got me there. And my intelligence. And so I felt like you know, this diagnosis of mental illness was taking away from all of who I had become. And, you know, I wasn't having any part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know that you were hospitalized. What was that experience like?
Well, if you remember the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, in my mind, that's what I felt like that hospitalization was like. But in reality, you know, looking back, it wasn't horrible. The one thing that had happened to me prior to that hospitalization was in a community-based hospital. I had that episode, psychotic episode, and they put me in restraints for 14 hours.
Wow.
And that caused a lot of trauma. And a lot of distrust of the system.
Yeah.
And, you know, not believing that people were there to help me, but rather to hurt me.
Right.
And that that didn't set me off on the right foot with mental health treatment.
No. I think a lot of times mental health treatment immediately scares the patient, and then they complain that, you know, the patients are resistant to go get help, but they don't give you too many reasons to want to go get help after your first couple times there. So,
yeah. And, you know, if you're coming into the system and, you know, I had a crisis, I call it a brain trauma.
You
know, my brain was traumatized. And then all of a sudden people are, you know, running in and saying, well, you've got this serious mental illness, bipolar disorder. And, you know, here's a bunch of pills, and this is what you have to do. And then 5 days later, they kick you out on the street.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no explanation in our current healthcare system on how do you manage this illness? You know, what do you need to do to take care of yourself? And dot, 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 by the way, recovery is possible.
Yes.
And there was none of that in there.
Yep.
You know, and there still isn't, and that really bothers me.
Yeah. I think that most of the places that use like the holistic treatment and self-compassion and all these new techniques that they find to work in addition to medication and therapy, you know, you need to spend, you know, 50 grand to go for a month. And that's just not possible for most people that are living with mental illness.
Right.
It's not possible for most people in general, you know, and it's just...
That's right.
And until they start incorporating like this holistic nutrition, you know, all these new approaches with the medication and the therapy, I don't think we're going to see a big change in mental health. And I think for that to happen, pharmaceutical companies need to get on board. Insurance needs to get on board. And I would just love to see that change in the near future.
You know, what is incredible to me is that, you know, insurance companies base so much of how long they'll let somebody stay in the hospital on utilization. But the thing is, if you've got someone that goes in to the hospital, gets kicked out in 6 days, and then within 3 or 4 weeks is back in the hospital again, that can't help your cost or your utilization. So
right.
You end up being this frequent flyer on in and out of hospitals because you can never get a handle on how to manage this illness, then it doesn't affect the insurance company's bottom line anyhow.
Yeah, exactly.
So you might as well do it right the first time. Right?
Yep, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think that that's the main thing that needs to be changed. And until politicians get on board with that, you know, I don't think it's ever going to happen because the budget is not going to be made, you know, to affect those changes. But I think that that's the only thing that will fix the mental health system right now is money and compassion.
Yeah, I would agree.
So after all your struggles with bipolar, you get through it, you start recovery, and then you decide to write a book. Tell me how that came about.
Well, I had been a mental health advocate for a few years and had pretty much publicly stated that I had bipolar disorder. And so what that meant to me was if you did a Google search, you were going to come up with Amy Gamble and mental illness kind of all in one sentence. So I decided that I wanted to help people. And if I could share my story and that might help one or two people, then sharing my story would be worth it.
Yeah.
And that was one part of it. And the other part of it is when you share something and you set out to help other people, what you end up finding is that the gratitude comes back to you tenfold.
Right.
And so, you know, not only did it help other folks, it's also helped me tremendously to kind of get that story off my chest and then, you know, move forward with my life.
That's awesome. I feel the same way. I feel the exact same way. That's why I wrote my poetry books, because I had this box of stuff that I had written and it just hurt me to look at it. But I knew that if I organized it in the right way and in the order that I went through the struggles and how those struggles turned into some of the best days of my life, like maybe I could guide somebody else in that direction, or maybe I could give somebody who's sitting at home looking at a bunch of filled up books afraid to release their stuff, maybe they're like, oh, maybe I could release a book, or I could get up on stage and read a poem. And that's there's really no better feeling than that. So I'm completely with you on that. But
you know, I had some very tumultuous experiences, and that's, you know, where I start off the book in that chapter. I'm putting myself in a small jail cell in Montana.
Yes.
And that happened to me as a result of untreated or undertreated bipolar disorder. And so I take accountability for not managing my illness better. But at the same time, while I was sick, I did not know that what I was doing was wrong.
Right.
You know, essentially I went into somebody's house, that wasn't mine. And I thought that it was mine. but I know that there are a lot of people out there who have had encounters, who have bipolar disorder or some other serious mental illness, that have had encounters with law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just feel like if you know that somebody else has been there, and that they've been able to recover, that maybe that's a lifeline of hope for people.
Yeah.
And that's something that I felt was important to share.
That it is, because when I was hospitalized, I was brought by police several times. And when I'd get out, the fear that I had that my whole town and, you know, all my friends from college and everybody I'd ever met in my life was going to be sitting at the dinner table talking about how I was restrained and brought to the hospital by the police. And I felt so alone after that. And so, yeah, when you do open up about something like this, I know it helps me. So I know it's helping others.
So. Yeah, I you know, I think that somewhere in the whole idea of where we as human beings have that shared, we share that pain, yeah. That there is a deep source of connection that we have with each other. And then that connection can actually provide healing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, if I know that I'm helping somebody, then that helps me heal too.
Yeah.
It's very empowering.
Do you mind if I read an excerpt from your book real quick?
No, please. Yeah, sure.
So this is a little piece that I liked, and this is about, well, I'll just read it. If I could offer one suggestion to people who may be on the outside looking in, I would say you don't have to have the right words or understand exactly what is going on. You just need to show kindness and compassion. This goes a long way and means the world to those of us who walk with mental illness on a daily basis. Sometimes the difference between feeling alone on the journey and feeling loved and supported comes down to someone asking the simple questions like, how is everything with you? Or are you doing okay? And I read that and I was like, I'm going to love this book. So I needed to read that because I think that alone, that in itself is going to help both sides. I think it's going to help the ones struggling and then the ones that need to support the one that's struggling. So, and I think we need to support, you know, our families too. And maybe that's something I needed to know when I was going through my struggle is that it's not easy for them. It's not easy for them at all. But it is something that you can ask about, and you could ask, how are you doing, without, you know, being too invasive. And I just thought that that was a great way to set up the book.
You know, yesterday I gave a talk to a group of college students, a couple hundred college students, a local university. And, you know, I'm talking about suicide and suicide warning signs, very deep conversation. And then I say these same words to them, that you don't have to have all the right words to say to somebody, but when you see that somebody's struggling, if you just ask them, are you okay? That can mean the world of difference to somebody. And you know, I can think back of so many times, and probably all of us who struggle or live with mental illness can think about the times when we wish we just had a friend that said to us, are you okay? And then you could have had that dialogue and conversation about, you know, no, I'm really not. I'm struggling right now.
Yeah.
And then there wouldn't be this overwhelming feeling of loneliness.
That's it. That's it. It's better to say, are you okay? And then to just let it go for years at a time and not say anything. Because it's not going to get any easier with time. I could tell you that's what mental illness, if you let it go, it's only going to get worse. You need to confront it head on and as soon as possible. So
absolutely.
Thank you for sharing that. But so tell our audience, where can they find the new book?
So you can find the book on Amazon, Amazon.com, Bipolar Disorder, My Biggest Competitor. And there's both the print copy as well as the electronic book, the Kindle version of the book as well.
Nice. And you're going to be doing a This Is My Brave soon?
We are here in the greater Wheeling area. We are doing This Is My Brave at the Capitol Theater, which is a historic venue built in the 1920s. It's just amazing. Nice. And we've got a cast of 16 people, and we are so excited to be doing This Is My Brave. And we just think that Jennifer Marshall is awesome.
Oh, we all do. Yeah. Yeah. We love Jen. Well, Amy, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you. I mean, I'm going to finish this book. I'm on chapter 15 or 16, and I promise I'm going to finish it. Sometimes books take me a while, so don't tell anybody. So for Mental Health News Radio and Hysteria Radio, I'm your host, Joe Fusaro. Remember to keep writing, keep creating, keep the music up to keep the hysteria down. Good night, everybody. Thank you.